Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... Conan Doyle for the defense.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
I hazard a guess that you are all familiar with that phrase, uttered in almost every film portrayal of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's literary creation, Sherlock Holmes. More about that utterance later. But what some folks don't know about Sir Arthur is that he was in every sense the alter ego of his creation. Conan Doyle was not only a brilliant spinner of mystery tales, but he was also an accomplished medical doctor and scientist. He was an expert in deductive and inductive reasoning, and in a time without high-tech scientific tools and tests, not even fingerprint analysis, he often helped Scotland Yard solve troublesome crimes. But in the case of Oscar Slater, he was on the other side of the authorities, advocating for the release of an innocent man. Why? Elementary, my dear listeners. It was the right thing to do. My guest today is Marguerite Fox, author of Conan Doyle for the Defense. Prior to writing this book and others, Ms. Fox worked writing obits for the New York Times of the famous and infamous alike. A perfect guest for Murder Most Foul. Wouldn't you agree? Welcome, Marguerite.
Thank you so much, Jim.
So before we begin discussing Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Marguerite, why don't you tell my audience a little bit about yourself, your writings, and maybe how you came to this story?
Well, I was a newspaper journalist for many years in New York, where I live. I spent 24 years at the New York Times, eventually becoming a senior writer there in their vaunted obituary news section. And you can just see behind me on the very end of the poster for the wonderful 2017 documentary Obit by Vanessa Gould about the work of my colleagues and me in the New York Times obituary department and what it's like to do that day in and day out. It's a marvelous documentary. I met her because she was a source for one of my other obits, and she became fascinated by what obituary writers do. While I was at the Times, I wrote my first three nonfiction books, and the one we're mostly talking about today, Conan Doyle for the Defense, came out the week I took early retirement from the paper in 2018 to devote myself to writing books full time. And so I've since had another book come out. I have yet another true crime book coming out next year, and I'm starting work on the one after that. So it goes.
Great. And how did you come by Conan Doyle for the Defense?
That had an interesting genesis, and it goes back over 30 years when I was a young professional in New York, very young, working at a dispiriting entry-level job in book publishing. And the book I had brought to read on my morning commute on the subway was John Dixon Carr's biography of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, published, I believe, in the 1940s. And standard biography, but somewhere around the end, almost in passing, Carr says, "Oh, by the way, Sir Arthur also took up the real-life case of a man wrongfully convicted for a brutal murder in Scotland in 1908, and over the next 20 years, using the methods of his famous literary detective, he exonerated this man who had been at hard labor for nearly two decades. Well, I almost dropped the book on the middle of the A train. I thought Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of the most famous literary detective, had played real life detective himself. And not only that, he had rectified a scandalous wrongful conviction that had been rooted in bigotry, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, you name it, all kinds of bad stuff. Why in the world isn't this fact and this case better known? Well, I was not in a position to do anything about it. I was unknown. I hadn't even been to journalism school yet. Fast forward 30 years when my previous book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth, had gone into production. I was casting about for what to do next, and I remembered the story of Arthur Conan Doyle and Oscar Slater, this poor, wrongfully convicted Jewish immigrant man, convicted of a brutal murder that the police knew full well he hadn't committed in Glasgow, Scotland in 1908, and languished for 18 and a half years at hard labor in a brutal, windswept prison on a barren, rocky outpost in the northeast of Scotland. And there in 1925, he managed to smuggle out a note hidden under the dentures of a fellow convict who was being paroled that day that said, "Go see Sir Arthur." And indeed, Conan Doyle, who had taken up the case years before without success, received this clandestine note and was moved to investigate the case one last time. And at long last, working with every clue, sifting court records, police records, finding corruption, working, brokering in back rooms of the highest corridors of British power, he was able to get Oscar Slater set free.
How did you go about doing research on this particular case and, of course, Conan Doyle's interest in defense? I couldn't find too much on Wikipedia or the internet about the case itself. So how did you go about doing research?
Wikipedia in particular and the internet more generally, I try to live by what I tell students. Use it only as a guide to find out what to confirm or disconfirm elsewhere from more reliable, authoritative printed sources. And as you said, there are probably dozens of biographies of Arthur Conan Doyle that have come out since his death in 1930. And every one of them has anywhere from a sentence or two to a chapter on the Oscar Slater case. But there are very few freestanding books devoted solely to the case. There are a couple in Britain, not well known, and to my surprise, but also delight when I was considering doing this project, there were no books on the case in this country. And that, I felt, gave me the green light to go ahead. As you said, research was paramount. And the way to do it, of course, is with primary sources. Happily, there are two major archives in Scotland on the case, one in Glasgow, where the murder occurred, and the other in Edinburgh, where the trial took place, and where Slater's exoneration also took place nearly two decades later. And so I spent a week in each city, literally sifting boxes, and I actually saw, because it's been preserved, it's in acid-free acetate coating, this smoothed out note written on brown tissue paper that had been crumpled up under this man's dentures and smuggled out of prison.
And I believe there's a picture of it in the book as I was
That's right. And I actually got to hold that in my hand. Fortunately, in acetate, so I didn't have, you know, 100-year-old saliva on it. But so that was very, very thrilling. And I ordered from the reprographics departments of these various archives, ream after ream after ream of documents. And about 6 months later, I have a photo of it somewhere, something like a dozen or 18 jiffy bags, each one bulging full of documents, arrived on my doorstep in New York. And I had a bad moment when I thought, oh my God, how am I ever going to go through all this stuff? But I eventually did, and you know, typed it up into probably over 1,000 pages of notes, but that formed the armature of my book.
And again, one of the lines that you have, I don't know if it's from someone else or yourself, that for me made me understand who Conan Doyle was, that I didn't know, that he was a scientist, he was a doctor. In a time, you know, so many 19, you know, oh, whatever. So we're not talking about current time. He was a doctor and a scientist. And one of the lines in the book quotes is, if you want to solve a crime, call a doctor. Better still, a doctor who is a crime writer. So if you're ready to, why don't we jump into December-ish 21st, 1908, give us the names of some of the parties and what happened to poor Mr. Oscar Slater.
Well, on the 21st of December, 1908, it's a dark, damp night just before Christmas in Glasgow, Scotland. A wealthy old woman, an 82-year-old woman named Marion Gilchrist, upright, regal-bearing, very patrician, lots of money. Not too many people liked her. She was had an iron will. Her maid, Helen Lambie, steps out at about 10 minutes to 7 to buy the evening paper, as is her custom every night. And she leaves her mistress, Miss Gilchrist, sitting in the parlor by the fireplace with her little gold-rimmed specs on, reading a magazine. So far, so good. Well, 10 minutes go by, and during the time that Helen is out, the downstairs neighbors hear a horrible thud from Ms. Gilchrist's apartment just above. And Ms. Gilchrist, who was fearful of robbery because she had thousands and thousands of pounds worth of jewelry secreted all over her apartment, she had arranged long before with the neighbors that if she were ever in trouble and needed help, she would rap 3 times on the floor between their flats. And that night, for the first and only time, the downstairs neighbors heard those 3 knocks. So one of the neighbors, a man called Adams, runs up. He can't get in, but suddenly a mysterious dark-haired man waltzes out of Ms. Gilchrist's apartment and flies down the steps to the street like greased lightning. Lambie, Helen Lambie, the maid, is back by this point. She doesn't know the man, so she says. Adams doesn't know him. They go in and find 82-year-old Marion Gilchrist brutally bludgeoned near death. A doctor is summoned, and by the time he gets there, Ms. Gilchrist has expired. It's a violent, violent murder. Blood everywhere, all over the crime scene. The police have no leads, except that Helen, the maid, looks around the flat and says, one piece of jewelry is missing, a brooch in the shape of a crescent moon set with diamonds. Well, a few days later, the police get a tip that a local man, a gambler named Oscar Slater, a Jewish immigrant from Germany, recently arrived in Glasgow, has pawned a diamond crescent brooch. So the police take Helen, the maid, to the pawn shop and said, is this your mistress' brooch? And she says, no, it's different. One brooch is set with a single row of stones. The other brooch has 3 rows of stones. Well, that should have been the end of the case against Oscar Slater then and there. But there were 2 things going on. One, just as we see on episodes of Law and Order today, it was a high-profile case. A rich woman gets murdered in her own home in a very elegant part of town where such things are simply not supposed to happen. And so the police are under enormous public pressure to get a suspect, get a conviction, close the case. That's number one. Number two, Oscar Slater was already known to the police because he lived on the fringes of Edwardian polite society. He was a foreigner. He was a Jew. He earned his living as a gambler, and he lived with a woman without benefit of marriage. She was reputed to be a lady of the evening, and therefore he was tarred by extension with being her pimp, although there was never any proof of that. And so it becomes for the police the neatest thing in the world to kill two birds with one stone. They wanted to run this lowlife out of town anyway, and they need to close the Marion Gilchrist murder. So, hey presto, they roll Oscar Slater up. They literally frame him. They suppress exculpatory evidence. They refuse to let alibi witnesses testify. They contrive all sorts of things to ensure that the case will not go his way. And in short, their theory seems to have been that Oscar Slater might as well have been hanged for a sheep as a lamb. And of course, he very nearly was hanged. It was very, very, very convenient for the police. And Slater went to trial at the High Court in Edinburgh, Scotland, the next spring. So it's the spring of 1909. And the judge actually dons the traditional black cap and sentences him to death. Now, Conan Doyle is not yet involved in the case, but there is enough public unease about the case, and at least in some newspapers and magazines, enough of an outcry and enough questions being raised that a public petition was gotten up to commute the death sentence that garnered something like 20,000 signatures from members of the public. And indeed, his sentence was eventually commuted by the monarch. It was Edward VII to life at hard labor. Not very good, but better than dying. And Oscar Slater came so close to being executed when he was in his cell after being sentenced. He could literally hear workmen erecting the gallows outside his cell.
Now, you point out in your book that the only real evidence against Mr. Slater, you know, aside from the brooch, which of course turns out not to belong to the victim, it was Mr. Slater's, the only was eyewitness testimony. And aside from being very unreliable, even today, it was shady to begin with.
They put ID made by witnesses who had been coached in whom to identify. So, surprise, surprise, they identified Oscar Slater. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the police prepared a very careful case, as did the Crown prosecutor, and who was doing the work of the police. And between the two of them, Oscar Slater didn't stand a chance. So in 1909, Slater's death sentence is commuted, and he is packed off to a life of penal servitude at Peterhead, which was a really brutal Victorian-era prison on it's the northernmost point on the east coast of Scotland, barren, windswept, and he and his fellow convicts basically spent, you know, hours and hours a day breaking up huge blocks of granite in the prison quarry. Really, really horrific conditions. Just a couple of years after, maybe 1911, 1912-ish, Conan Doyle first gets involved, we think at the behest of Slater's lawyers. And the reason they went to him is he had already established something of a public reputation as an investigator of true crimes. Because of the success of the Holmes stories, which were first published in the late 1880s and continued for the next 40 years, members of the public and sometimes police officials would actually start to consult Conan Doyle on deaths, disappearances, wrongful convictions, things that they just couldn't unravel. And using the scientific methods that he had imparted to Sherlock Holmes, and which he himself had learned impeccably as a medical student, he very often was able to unravel some of these cases. The direct link between Conan Doyle the doctor and Conan Doyle the crime writer is his brilliant med school professor, a man named Joseph Bell. Now, Joseph Bell was a tall, as Conan Doyle describes him, eagle-nosed Scotsman. This is at the University of Edinburgh, who was such a brilliant inductive diagnostician. He could look at a patient, a man or woman he'd never seen before, and literally by the cut of their clothes, the calluses on their hands, their accents, the kind of mud on their shoes as they had walked to the hospital that day, he could literally tell, you know, who they were, where they came from, what they did for a living, often what their complaint was before he even examined them. And he would say, you know, I see, sir, you are a military man and you have been stationed at Barbados. Your complaint is elephantiasis. And he was almost always right. Now, whom does that sound like? And indeed, as Conan Doyle readily acknowledged, Joseph Bell became the model for the fictional Sherlock Holmes.
You look as if you've been attacked.
Obviously, my dear Watson. Dr. Tobel, do you suspect the woman of arranging the trap?
Woman? What woman?
She's blonde, 5'6", full-lipped, and very affectionate.
Oh, really?
You've known her for a long time. You were attacked after leaving her apartment.
Holmes, how do you know this?
The face powder on your coat tells me of her height and her affection for you. You, held her close before departing.
Did it, Holmes?
It's all there for the trained eye to read, Watson.
But look here, why couldn't he have been attacked on his way to the woman's apartment?
The mark of a blow has erased some of the powder. Obviously, if the attack came first, the powder would have remained undisturbed.
And the full lips? That was a guess.
I never guess, Watson. You have rubbed the lipstick from your face with the handkerchief you now hold in your hand. And that amount of lipstick never came from a pair of thin lips.
And the blonde hair? Good gracious me.
Mr. Holmes, I am glad you are on my side.
So I think it's important to impress on my audience that at the time that Conan Doyle was writing and also, you know, investigating this in other cases, there was not forensics. There's not certainly scientific ways to prove a different blood type and things like that. So Conan Doyle was relying solely on his keen sense of observation.
Right, because police science as we know it, forensics as we know it, didn't exist. Fingerprinting as a technique was brand new. Interestingly, there are only, in the entire Sherlock Holmes canon, there are only about half a dozen instances where the use of fingerprinting is invoked. I mean, that was how new it was, that even it didn't really resonate that much with Conan Doyle himself. And he kept up with this stuff more than civilians did. But most police departments didn't have it. And even if you knew how to take fingerprints, there would be barely any time for the department to have built up a database of people's prints. So you might have prints, but nothing to compare it to. And then the more science-based, lab-based, empirical test tube forensic studies that we know from television really didn't even begin to take hold till the 1930s and 40s. So in 1908, when this murder took place, we're a long way from that yet. So police departments are using what we would call junk science, not always volitionally, but in a sense, they were going on their gut. And while that may be helpful in some instances, it's not sufficient. And of course, what they were going on in the Slater case, and it's safe to assume many others, is just reflexive prejudice. You know, here's a man who doesn't look like us. He talks with an accent. He's a Jew. He's a gambler. Let's run him out of town, even if it means, you know, stitching him up for a murder conviction and sending him to the hangman.
Thank you.
So what court or authority did Conan Doyle turn to fight the conviction?
And you've put your finger on something urgent that bears mentioning, because it's so shocking to us in this country today. When Oscar Slater was convicted and sentenced to death, the reason there had to be a public petition got up to commute his sentence, and that it went all the way to the British monarch, Edward VII, who was the only person legally empowered to commute it, was that there was no appeals court in Scotland then. So if you got a death sentence, you were pretty much dead. It's shocking to us. An appeals court wasn't instituted until about 1925, partly as a result of the agitation around the Slater conviction. Slater had not even yet been freed when he was. The appeals court had to be specially empowered to review his case retroactively, and his conviction was eventually quashed. That took some time. That happened in the late 1920s. So this is so shocking. So what Conan Doyle did, since there was no appeals case to prepare, since there was no court to prepare it for, he went back, like the literary and scientific man he was, and just sifted the records. He read all the newspaper coverage around the trial. He read the trial transcripts, and over the years, with help from various Scottish journalists who did the legwork. Conan Doyle was getting older at that point. He was remarried to his second wife, I think disinclined to leave the comforts of his home in England and run up to Scotland. He had various people re-interviewed. They eventually located the maid, Helen Lambie, who had testified that she didn't know this mysterious man who had sallied forth from the murder apartment at the time she was trying to get back into it, and that Slater was indeed the man who murdered her mistress. They got Helen Lambie to recant. She had indeed been coached by police and prosecutors. That made a huge difference. It was an enormous story in the papers, even almost 20 years later, when she recanted. And that was one of the pry bars that allowed Conan Doyle and his associates to leverage the official reopening and rehearing of the case.
You have a picture of her in the book, and from a newspaper, and underneath it is a quote. This woman, one of Slater's supporters declared, holds the secret. And she did, and she told it. So the overturning of Oscar Slater's conviction came through this newly constituted appeals court, right?
That's right. In 1909, at Slater's original trial, the judge sentenced him to death. There was no appeals court then. A public petition was got up, and as a result, the king commuted his sentence to life at hard labor, but they were not going to exonerate him completely. They weren't going to set him free. And so he languished in jail for something like 18 and a half years, right? Only after, through Conan Doyle's reinvestigation, Conan Doyle himself published a monograph in, I believe, 1912, highlighting all of the laws and fallacies and, as we would say, junk science, illogic, prejudice, just wrongheadedness in the original prosecution. And then some years later, Conan Doyle himself was the editor and publisher of a book by the Scottish journalist William Park that re-examined the case even more deeply. I believe it was Park who went and found Helen Lambie in America, got her to recant. Now, only then was Slater eventually freed by a decision from a very high level of the British government, and indeed, after he was free, in this new appeals court, the court was empowered to actually revisit his case, and his conviction was overturned, or as they say there, quashed. Partly through Conan Doyle's agitation, the British government did give Slater an award, what we might call compensatory damages. I believe it was £6,000, which this is 1928, 1929, was quite a lot of money. And it would have been enough for Slater to live carefully. Tragically, Conan Doyle and Slater, who never met until the review of Slater's case after he'd been freed in the late 1920s, which Conan Doyle came up to Scotland to cover for a British newspaper, they'd never met face to face. Conan Doyle was kind of Victorian man, although he himself was Scottish and had come from extreme poverty. He, at this point, was probably one of the most highly paid, if not the most highly paid authors in the world. He had a lavish lifestyle down in England. He was, you know, he'd become a real patrician. And Slater, it's very clear that Slater's shady lifestyle discomforted him deeply. He, in fact, in his 1912 monograph about all of the flaws in the case against Slater, Conan Doyle called him a disreputable rolling stone of a man. But this is what is so wonderful about Conan Doyle. He was so moral and so rigorously logical that it was clear that even a shady immigrant gambler did not deserve to be railroaded for a crime he didn't commit. And Conan Doyle was very articulate about that.
That's great. Now, we also, I think I came to the, somewhere in the book near the end, there was never anyone, of course, after all these years, there was no one else charged.
Correct. They, to this day, we don't know who committed the murder. Conan Doyle had a theory that it was, well, I'll leave it to those who want to read the book, but let's just say that one of the things found in the crime scene, besides the ocean of blood in the parlor where Marion Gilchrist was killed, was that in one of the bedrooms in her elegant flat, although none of her vast collection of jewelry had been disturbed, with the possible exception of the diamond brooch, if in fact that really had gone missing, that's an open question. The other salient feature of the crime scene was that a wooden box in the bedroom had been wrenched open and the papers it contained were scattered all over the floor. And as Conan Doyle points out in his monograph about the case, what, with the exception of a will, could induce someone to break in, wrench open a box, and frantically rifle through papers? Conan Doyle had a private theory about who the real killer might be. He thought it might have been a member of the extended family. You know, there's arguments over probate, arguments over legacy. But he was a gentleman. Conan Doyle was a gentleman, a man of honor. This man on whom his private suspicions focused was also a very eminent professional man in Glasgow society. And so Conan Doyle knew far better than to tar someone based on supposition, even educated supposition. But we know from his private correspondence that he did have a theory.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
I would be remiss if I let you go. I do want to talk about another book that you wrote that is not about a murder, but it's fascinating.
It's called The Confidence Men.
Confidence Men. So tell us, I want to tease my audience, so we're not going to give them all the deets, but give us like the back jacket on it so I can get people to want to go get it.
Well, if I were doing an elevator pitch for The Confidence Men to an editor or a Hollywood producer, they would think I had lost my marbles, because the editor The elevator pitch for this nonfiction book goes exactly like this. In the depths of World War I, two handsome young British officers escaped from a remote Turkish prisoner of war camp using a Ouija board. Now, that sounds absolutely mental, yet that is literally what happened in this true story.
Good, and that's it. And no, we're not going to say anything more. I did read it, so I do know that it's as crazy as it sounds. It is worth then picking it up, even if you don't like crazy. So I do want people to. And again, it's available at your local Barnes and Noble, but it is also available at your local library. Because again, as I told you before, that my wife brought home both books at the same time, and I read the Conan Doyle first and then that one. So as we wrap up, first of all, it's been a magnificent hour with Marguerite Fox on her book Conan Doyle for the Defense, and she's working on other things, and the Obit thing is fascinating. I will go look at that doc. It's probably a YouTube available thing now, right?
Well, I hope not for the sake of the filmmaker, but I believe you can get it on, you know, various streaming places.
Well, yeah, that's what I meant. I mean, it's old enough to be on streaming now, right? Did it originally come out?
No, it had a theatrical release.
Oh, it did.
We journalists had a lot of fun going around to film festivals and doing audience talkbacks.
Nice.
So I believe it's on, you know, Apple
or Amazon,
and all those things that I don't
Prime,
know anything about. So, right. So, if you just, the filmmaker's name is Vanessa Gould, G-O-U-L-D. So, if you just search Vanessa Gould and Obit, I'm sure it'll come right up.
How would they get in touch with you?
Probably the easiest way is through my website, which is just my name, MargueriteFox.com.
Hey. No, it's easier. Absolutely. Well, again, this has been fantastic. I wish you great luck. If you were saying you're doing another crime book, maybe in the works next or the one after that, is there any murder, death, or mayhem involved?
Well, interestingly, I have another true crime book coming out from Random House next summer, the summer of 2024. It is about a very unusual, very unlikely early American syndicated crime boss.
Well, I'll certainly read it. Does he kill anybody?
Well, I will say only that it's not a he, it's a she.
Wow, that's even better. Look at that. I love it. Now, before I let you go, Marguerite, before we were recording in a pre-interview, you mentioned that you have a funny story about touring with the book, with a book talk. So why don't you let us end on a funny note. So tell us that story.
So in 1909, when Slater's trial concluded, he was convicted and sentenced to death. And so when I give public talks about it, of course, I highlight that moment. And I got the surprise of my life. One time I was speaking at a synagogue in New Jersey, and unbeknownst to me, on a table right behind me, one of the custodians had left his walkie-talkie, and it was still on. And so I get to this very somber part, and I'm telling my assembled multitudes, so the conviction is handed down. The learned judge dons the traditional black cap to sentence Oscar Slater to death. He turns to the gallery and says, and from behind me, "We need more toilet paper downstairs."
That's all, folks.
So on that note, let me bid you a fond farewell, or I should say, adieu.
Thank you. It was great fun.
And as many of you, my listeners, know, especially you Holmes scholars, in the books penned by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes never uttered the catchphrase, "Elementary, my dear Watson," heard in almost every movie. But that's okay. We love it when Basil Rathbone punctuates a scene with it. I even found a clip where Watson turns it around on Holmes.
"Elementary, my dear Holmes. Elementary."
So I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So, until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.